Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and you can find us under that name on Facebook and also check out our Facebook page at Italian Genealogy. Today I have a special guest, Mike Canzaniero, who is the author of two books, Papa's Story, America Through the Eyes of a Brave Italian Immigrant, and The Evil Eye, The Pure Heart. So welcome, Mike. Thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Bob. Happy to be joining you today.
So just a little bit about your Italian roots. Your grandfather came very early, didn't he?
Yes, he came at a time when most Italians settled on the West Coast. In fact, when he came around 1890, there were more Italians on the West Coast than there were on the East Coast. Many of them settling in California, the Santa Fe and San Francisco areas. They went out and became the beginners of vineyards and the guys that would do the fishing in San Francisco. A lot of Sicilians did fishing in San Francisco. Yeah.
So he was originally from Sicily?
He was originally from the town of Albano di Lucania, which is in Basilicata in southern Italy. And he came here after training to be a fresco painter. He was going to paint those beautiful frescoes in the churches. He came at 18 years old. And a very interesting story. I should tell you this as a little bit of background. My grandfather, his brothers, and he decided that Albano di Lucania was no place. They were too many landslides. They were all sharecrop farmers at first, then they became stonemasons because there wasn't enough land to farm anymore. And what happened was that the brothers went to South America. They went to Argentina, his older brothers. He stayed behind and trained as a fresco artist. And when he was ready to immigrate, he decided to go to San Francisco because his mentor had said you'd find more work out there. There are more churches being built in San Francisco. And to make the story more interesting, as he is traveling, once he gets to this to New York and then gets on a train, he meets a woman, falls in love with her, and they marry when they got out to San Francisco shortly after he got out there. Before he married her, he found that there was no work for him as a sign painter, fresco painter. So he began painting signs on the sides of brick buildings. You know, these signs that say drink Coca-Cola or shop at this store or that store. That was his job. He would hang from a single rope with cans of paint around his waist and swing back and forth and paint these signs on the sides of buildings. And, that was how he got started in this country. Anyway, he married this woman. They have twins out there. The wife and children die of the Russian flu. And he comes back to New York. What's interesting about that story is that when he passed, he hadn't told any of his children that he'd ever been married before. They never knew the story. So I'm telling my father the story about his father having been married before and the children dying, etc. My father says to me, "Where did you hear this? I never knew this story. Neither did any of his siblings," and he had seven of them. So it was a fascinating thing that my grandfather only confided that in me. And, I always felt very privileged. And in fact, it was part of the inspiration to write his story, recognizing that I knew stories that my father had no idea about how my grandfather came here. Fascinating, fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I read that the Russian flu. I had never heard of the Russian flu before. Read it in your little bio there.
Yeah. Had been an issue, and then it kind of came and went, pretty much like COVID is doing right now. Yeah.
Wow. That's something. Yeah.
More devastating in Europe than it was in America, but unfortunately, his family was wiped out by it.
So now, he came back to New York, and then so I guess he started a second family.
Yes, and it was kind of interesting because his father remained obviously behind in Italy and was a stonemason there. And one of his friends from the quarry was asking him, which country should we go to? Should we go to South America like your older sons, or should we go to America? And my grandfather suggested that my grandfather's father suggested that it was better to go to America, the United States, and he made arrangements for when this fellow's family came to the States, my grandfather would help them through immigration. And he met my grandmother there and fell in love with her. And that's the story, you know. They came from neighboring towns in Potenza, the Potenza area of Italy, and fell in love with my grandmother. And they had 8 kids. My father, being the youngest, was the one who was supposed to become the family priest. What's interesting about that is that my grandfather was also supposed to be a priest in his family, and I was supposed to be the priest in my family. So we had 3 generations of failed vocations.
Well, that's funny that you say that, because my grandfather, my father's father, was studying to be a priest in Naples.
Yeah.
He used to tell the story, which at the time, you know, I was a little kid, I used to believe that my grandmother used to come by and flirt with him, and that's why he left. But I found out from another cousin that supposedly the real story is that my grandmother, who came from a wealthy family, her carriage broke down in front of the seminary, and he happened to be outside and he helped repair it, and they gave him a ride, and you know, the rest is history, I guess. But so I guess neither one of us was supposed to be here.
I'm very happily married with 4 kids and 11 grandkids.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I saw that.
Yeah.
So when he got back to New York, then what did he do? Did he continue doing the sign painting?
It's very interesting. Yes, he had his own business there. And unfortunately, after a number of years, he fell from a scaffold several stories up, fell with another couple of guys, one of whom was fatally killed, and the other was also injured, but not as severely as my grandfather. My grandfather had a broken leg and could not climb scaffolds or do that work anymore as a sign painter. So he was fortunate enough, they were building the subways at that time, and he got a job tiling the subways. He had been trained to do mosaics back in Italy, when he was also being trained as a fresco painter. His mentor was an excellent a mosaicist. And so my grandfather knew how to do mosaics. And if you've been to some of the city's subways, you'll see not only, you know, 125th Street in this tiling, but they also used to use objects that were found in the area of that subway station. So you did that. You put like a beaver at this station because it was known to, you know, it was Beaver Street or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because people couldn't read, and they couldn't necessarily read the sign. So if you had an image that would tell you, oh, you get off where the subway station shows a beaver, people would know that that's how they would travel the subways. Because they couldn't read, it was easier at that time to put up images as well as the words. And so my grandfather did these mosaics. And that was the second job that he had in this country.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com. Well, that's quite a legacy, and I didn't know that. You know, I rode the subway for I don't know how many years. I never knew that. I mean, I know the The mosaics that you mean. Oh, that's so interesting. I'm going to have to go back and look now and look at some of these signs.
He did that, and they would paint the numbers of the, the streets on the pillars underground there, and he painted those and so on. So, when he couldn't go up on the scaffolds any longer to be a sign painter, this is what he did here. And then eventually, when the subways were fairly well completed, he became a house painter. And that was interesting too, because in many cases he was working doing gold leaf and there's stories in the book that I tell about him learning how to do wallpapering and so on, and but he was able to do gold leaf on store windows, attorneys' shops and things like that. And he was a very talented man, very talented.
My uncle used to he was a painter for the city, and he would paint the bridges, the Washington Bridge, the Whitestone Bridge, and even the Empire State Building, like 86 floors up. Crazy.
Brave people, brave people.
He said he. I remember him telling me that the only other people up there, it was him and the Indians, because the Indians in New York used to paint all those high places and everything. So you have an interesting story about his watch.
Back when he was in San Francisco and marrying for the first time, he bought a gold watch, and he was very proud of that watch. He took it to the wedding and he kind of showed it off and so on. He would always pull the watch out when I would sit with him, and I was very fond of the watch. Well, to make a long story short, though he had four sons, when he passed, he left a little box, and my grandmother presented it to me. She said, "Your grandfather wanted you to have it." I opened the box up, and it's his gold watch, but it wasn't with its gold chain and fob. That was missing. He always had the gold watch on a beautiful gold chain with a $10 gold fob piece at the end of it. And I said, "What happened to that?" And she said, "Oh, it's a long story," and she didn't tell me about it. Well, my father was like surprised I got this, because why didn't one of his brothers get it? That sort of thing. And I was very proud of it. I kept it. She passed 10 years after my grandfather, and she left another little box. And in this little box, there was a note with the gold chain and fob, and it said, "I had nothing to give you. So when Grandpa left you the gold watch, I took the chain off it so that I could give it to you when I pass. Now, when you put both of these things together again, it'll be like you have Grandpa and Grandma with you." It was just the sweetest little note. It brings tears to my eyes to even think about it today.
Yeah, that's a great story. So now it must have been your grandfather, he must have been pretty old compared to you, right?
I was the youngest grandson. He died at 90, and I was about 13 when he died. But I tell the story. We moved from the projects, the Jacob Riis projects, where my family first settled, my mother and father. It was dangerous. I was beaten up as a 5-year-old kid. There was a fellow that hated me, another 5-year-old, tough little guy. He whipped a piece of barbed wire across my face at one point, dropped a stone on my head at another point. And my grandfather says to my father, "You got to get that kid out of there before they kill him." So my grandfather found a house that was near to his own, in the Bronx there, a block away, and encouraged my father to buy it. And with the help of his relatives, my uncles on both sides of the family, they rebuilt this house a bit, and we settled there. But I had to pass my grandfather's house on the way to school every day, back and forth. And if I passed and didn't stop in the house, if the school was out, he would tap on the window, "Come in, come in." And I would have to come in, and I would sit by him, and he would tell me these stories. Stories, like I said, that the rest of the family never heard before. You know, so I had a very, very close and loving relationship with him. You know,
yeah, that's wonderful. That's super. Did he talk at all about, you know, Italy, what life was like in Italy?
Yeah, he did. He, you know, one of the things that he told me about, and I describe it in the book, was that what happened in the 1830s is that the landowners in southern Italy began, you know, it's a very difficult land to farm in the first place. It's very hilly. But the landowners began allowing forestry to come in and tear away the trees. By tearing away the trees, it led to landslides onto the little bit of farmable land that there was down there. So the conditions became worse and worse, and the farmers could not make enough from their little plots of land. They all then became sharecroppers. They went to the big estates and they, you know, bartered with these guys to let them farm their land in return for taking some food off it, that sort of thing. But these landowners were unscrupulous people. I don't know if you know that there was, you know, a rule they call the prima notte, where the landowners had the right to have sex with any peasant that worked for them, including a bride on her wedding night. I mean, it was just a crazy, crazy time back then. And so with less and less land to farm and more poverty hitting, they tell a story about scraping the stucco off the sides of their buildings, their homes, and adding it into the dough so that the bread could be stretched a little further. I mean, that's how poor things were down there. And so what happened with my grandfather's father and a couple of his brothers before they went to Argentina is that they went off and became masons. For a while, the stones in Caria, that area, that the Caria marble that you talk about, that was becoming too expensive. So people wanted to have cheaper stones, and they were taking stones from Matera and the areas around Basilicata. And so these guys that were formerly farmers went and became masons and cut stones and so on. And so my grandfather had no desire to be a mason. He wanted to be an artist, and he was very good. And so when the brothers decided to go to Argentina, they became masons, stone cutters for railroads in Argentina. They worked on the railroads, cutting stones and doing things like that. But my grandfather, he decided he was going to be an artist and not the stone cutter. But when my grandfather eventually married my grandmother, her father, my grandmother's father, he had been a mason. And so coming to this country, he started up a tombstone business, you know, made gravestone. And one of my uncles, one of my father's brothers, became one of his employees and eventually became a very, very wealthy man, making these granite marble tombstones for St. Raymond's Cemetery, if you know where that is in the Bronx. He was very popular there, very well. So, yeah, the family's conditions, though, were very, very poor. And as I say, it was, you know, not unusual. I forget what the statistic was, but I think that there was a point at which 60 or 70% of the people from Basilicata were going to America. You know, they were birds of passage, as you know. They would return, they would make some money in this country and then go back to try to buy more land from the estates. But, you know, they fled Italy. Yeah.
No, yeah, I know. It was a rough life, you know, for sure. So how old was he when he came?
He was 18. He was 18. Yeah.
And he came by himself. He just came by himself.
He came by himself. More fascinating, the other side, my father's father and that family were more gentrified in the end. My father's family was lucky in that my grandfather and his brothers got educations, which not a whole lot of people in southern Italy got. So, and he prized education. And when he came here, he made sure that all of his children went to school and they went pretty far. I think four of them were a college graduate, which was highly unusual for that generation. My mother's family is different. They were peasants in Italy, probably even worse shape than my grandfather's family. They came from a little town called Pomarico, which was probably about an hour's walk or journey from Potenza, where my grandfather came from, Albano di Lucania. In any event, my mother's family was a lot poorer. But the interesting thing there is that my grandmother, my mother's mother, came over at 16 by herself and settled in New York, the Italian Harlem. And what happened was that she met her husband, another guy from that area. They married in New York, and this is in 1901 that they marry. And when she got pregnant, my grandfather said, "America's no place for you to have a kid. Right now, we're too poor. I'm going to send you back to Italy. You'll live with my parents. I'll make some money, and then I'll come and I'll send for you when I have a better place to live than this shithole, excuse my language, that we're living in now." My grandmother has the baby in Italy, and she sends my grandfather a lock of my Uncle Michael's hair. And my grandfather decides, "I'm going back too, and I'm never coming back to this place." My grandmother couldn't wait to come to America. And my grandfather, my mother's father, becomes somewhat successful as a wine merchant in Italy. He goes around selling the Anglia grape that is only that part of Italy, in that the Matera area. And he's pretty successful, but he's an alcoholic and he's violent and he's beating my grandmother. And by the time that my oldest uncle is 16 years old, he comes home one night and he's about to beat my grandmother. And instead, my 16-year-old uncle takes a chair and beats him over the head, knocks him out. My grandfather then gets a gun. And he's going to kill my uncle. And my grandmother says, "You're going to America. You got to get away from this crazy man." And he did. My uncle came here at 16, and he started an ice business in this country. The people from Basilicata, when they came here, they were known as the ice people. They were delivering ice to residents and businesses, etc. And so he makes a little money, and there's a reconciliation between my grandfather and he. And then my grandfather comes over, and you know the story. The rest of the family comes. And they get here by 1922, a couple of years later, and there would be a law passed about, immigration quotas being sent. You're familiar with that. And so they make it here. But what's a There's a couple of interesting stories about coming here. One of the things, my mother was a 7-year-old at the time. And when my grandmother is leaving Italy for the second time, she spits on the shores and says, "I hope I never come back to this godforsaken place." That's it. And when they arrive through Ellis Island, my grandmother has now four of the kids with her, my mother being one of the younger ones. And her sister, who's a couple of years older than my mother. So my mother was seven. I think her sister was maybe nine. One of her sisters develops a fever sore. Now, at immigration, you have a fever sore, you're put in the hospital. And she had to stay there. But my grandmother and the other three children also had to stay on the island, where they said the conditions were worse than it had been in steerage. The dormitory set up for the people that had to be housed while someone is in the hospital were worse than the steerage on the ship. My grandfather is allowed to come and visit. He's already, as I said, established here. And so when he comes and he sees his daughter with a little fever sore, he rips off the scab, which of course meant that she had to stay even longer. It just crazy sort of stuff. But eventually, you know, they get here and, you know, they settle in Italian Harlem. And my mother's family, the women became seamstresses. You know, they worked in the sweatshops. The men then got into my uncle's ice business with him. My grandfather basically took it over. You know, this was my business. You know, he had illusions. My mother's father always had illusions of being a padrone, you know, one of these tough guys that, you know. And so at the age of 50, he retired, and he would have all of his children, married and unmarried, come to him, present him with their money, and he would determine how much each one needed to live. Even after they were married, it was crazy, just crazy, you know. So when the ice business was going out because refrigerators were coming in, my uncles, who by this time were now distributing ice to meat butcher shops and produce stores, they make arrangements to go into those businesses. So they moved from the ice businesses. One became a grocer, successful grocer. The others became butchers. Fascinating stories, though, yeah. You know, but my mother was the only one of her 10 siblings to go further to graduate from high school. None of them other than her succeeded any further than eighth grade. And she was the best educated. Perhaps that's why she married my father, who actually was a college graduate. So we were, my sisters and myself became really the first ones in the families to not only go to college, but also get advanced degrees. I got the PhD. Interesting about that. I'll just take a second with this. My friends all call me Doc, but that was a nickname I was given as a child because my uncles decided that I reminded them of Bugs Bunny. You would think they would call me Bugs, but no, they used to say all the time, "What's up, Doc?" And then that became my name. And so there was something about that. My family always says, you were preordained, you know, to become a doctor. But my patients all call me Doc as well. And all my good friends call me Doc. So, you know, but we were the first, my sisters and myself, to really, we were the first to get advanced degrees. Yeah, I consider myself a very fortunate guy. Very, very fortunate.
Yeah. Well, you know, they instilled the work ethic. My grandfather, my mother's father, was actually, they were icemen too. They were from Puglia, not far from Basilicata. Yeah. And they also, I think it was my uncle's business, my great uncle's business. And, you know, my uncle and my grandfather and some of my uncles, I guess in the, you know, 20s and 30s and I guess early 40s even, would deliver on ice. And people don't realize that these guys would carry 50 or 100 pounds on their back.
And one of my oldest cousins, when the ice business was still the family business, he used to tell me of the story that he said, before I went to school in the morning, at 5 in the morning, my father would take me and I would go with him to deliver the ice before I went to school in the morning. He used to look at me and say, you don't know how lucky you are. To have been born a little later. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I think we all are. So now, have you been back to, you know, the hometowns? Have you been back there?
Yes, I have. Very interesting story. My sister and her husband, my wife and I, went back to Pumarico. And we were walking through the town. And as we're walking, I hear a woman say in Italian, she's standing out in front of her apartment, and she says in Italian, "He looks like Grandpa." And we pass her by, and we're looking for a policeman, and I see this cop, and I say, you know, we're Cerises and D'Amato. That was my mother's family names. And I say, are there any people in this town? I know it's my mother's home. And he said, you know, the best person to talk to is the woman who runs the cleaners over here. So he points me to this cleaning shop, and I go in, and the cleaners, the woman, saleswoman, says to me, "Oh, Cerise D'Amato." She walks outside. She points to the women who said, "He looks like Grandpa." She says, "Those are D'Amato's." We walk up to them, and they just flew out of this apartment, and they start embracing the four of us, before a word is spoken. And we walk inside, and sure enough, there are our relatives. There's pictures of my grandmother and my aunts hanging on the wall. And, we just had this wonderful, it was a weekday, but we had this wonderful Sunday dinner. You know how we Italians put out a dinner, right? And all the kids come, all the relatives come, and we're exchanging stories. And it was just the most wonderful, wonderful day. It really was.
Now, did they know that they had cousins in America?
Oh,
They knew. So they knew.
No, as I say, they had pictures of my grandmother and my aunts and uncles on the
But
walls in the house.
they didn't know about you.
No, they didn't
Yeah.
know about me. And I couldn't speak Italian very well. My brother-in-law, who is fluent in Spanish, although he's Italian, he was able to communicate, and we were able to get things communicated, pretty well. But it was just the most wonderful day,
Well,
But to
and
see where they
I've heard
are.
a few stories like that, and I tell people all the time, you don't know what you're going to find when you get to these towns. I mean, like you said, you go in there, you give the name, and you all of a sudden you find out you have relatives. It's incredible. It really is.
And we went from there, we went to Albano di Lucania, where my other grandfather was from. And we're walking around there. And I have an unusual name, Canzanero. I didn't think it was that common a name. But we walk into his town, and it's a beautiful little place high up in the mountains. And, we find somebody, and we're trying to communicate, and we explain that, where Canzanero is. And they point to the statue in the middle. There was a war memorial in the center of the town. And on it is the names of people who were killed in World War I. And among the names is Rocco Canzanero. My father's name is Rocco. And the story that we hear is that one of my father's brothers stayed behind in Italy. He never immigrated. And his oldest son was killed in World War I, but killed just before my own father was born. And my grandfather decided that he would name the child that was born Rocco in honor of the son, that the cousin, my father's cousin, that was killed in World War I. And so to go there and see the name Rocco Canzanero on this war memorial, recognize the story of how my father got the name in honor of him, et cetera, was just fascinating. Just fascinating. But the other thing we found out is that the brother that stayed behind created a vineyard, and a pretty successful one at that. But he passed without any heirs. And it was in his will that it should go to my father because he was named after his son who had passed away. My father never claimed it. The state took it over, I guess. I don't know if we still have any claim on it, but it's just fascinating to go back there and then find out, that there was the statue and the story that was associated with it. And then to find out that, oh, when we were looking around and talking to people, they said, Canzanero, everybody in this town is a Canzanero. There
Yeah.
aren't many in Italy, in America, but there were quite a few there. So it was great. It was great. It was.
I know, I've heard that too, is that people, the towns, they were so small and so these out of the way places. People that didn't leave the town,
And it's, my kids all went to Notre Dame. And one of my three of my kids did a semester abroad, and they got to travel. And my daughter tells the story that she was traveling with a friend, and they were going to, I forget where it was, it might have been Naples. And they were on a bus, and as they were going to their seats on the bus, a woman who was already seated tapped my daughter's friend on the hand, and she said, Are you a Napolitano? Is that your last name? And the girl said, yes. She said, well, you look like somebody I know. And then they wound up going off the bus, going with this lady, meeting this a friend of my daughter's whole family. I mean, it was just, how do those coincidences occur? It was just, you look like somebody. My experience with walking in the town and Monaco and the woman saying you look like grandpa, and then this friend of my daughter's
Yeah,
on the bus.
there aren't any.
And
I
that's
don't
the
think
way.
there were accidents. I mean, when we met my
No.
father's cousins last year, I had no idea that he had first cousins still alive in Italy. Nobody ever
Oh,
said
wow.
anything. And
Wow.
I was in contact with because my grandfather had a, my great grandfather, my great grandmother passed away when she was 42. He had another family. He was 60 and he married a woman 30. So their two daughters of my father's age. And I had no idea about them. And then I also didn't know that my grandmother's youngest brother, because there were 18 years between them, that he had two daughters in their 90s, alive in Torre del Greco. And we go up the stairs, and one of my grandmother's, she looked just like my grandmother. I mean, and they knew they had same thing. They had my parents' wedding picture from
Yes,
1944 that my grandmother had sent. And I was blown away by all of this stuff. It was just incredible to you. Again, I had no idea that my first cousins, not second, not third,
Oh, I know
first
what you mean.
cousins,
Yeah, amazing,
But that's why I tell
amazing.
people, I said, if you go to Italy, everybody wants, they want to see Rome, they want to see Venice, they want. I tell them all the time, if you know where you come from, you have to go. You have to go.
My son did that about 4 years ago. He went with his son to both Pomodico and to Albano di Lucania, and he said they, just wandered the streets and asked people, do you know the D'Amatos? Do you know the Canzoneros? And and he said people would just open the doors and take them in. And he said, Dad, you had a feast. I had a feast. They didn't, I'm third generation.
Yeah,
And
it
they
doesn't
treat me
matter.
as royalty.
Yeah, they have a whole different mentality than Americans. That's for sure. There's no question about that. And they value their history and their heritage, and they're genuinely happy to see us.
You're treated a little like a celebrity, though. I mean,
Yes.
that's the feeling I had. They're so pleased that you've come back and been successful. And I think that's part of the joy, that.
Yeah, no, it's true. So before we go, the first book is about your grandfather. The second book, we didn't touch on it too much, but the second book is about your grandmother. That's your grandmother's story, correct?
Right. Actually, that was the first one that I did. I did that 3 years
Oh, okay.
ago. And I don't know if I've told this story, but why I wrote my grandfather's story is that I was actually, about 8 or 10 months ago, I was actually holding the book about my mother's mother in my hand, and I got a chill down my spine. And I looked up, and I have my grandfather's gold watch in little case above the fireplace, and I looked at that watch, and the chill continued. And I said, "He's telling me I have to write his story." And that's honest to God, that's how
I
that
believe it.
happened.
I believe it.
I wrote that story, just fascinating there. But yeah, the first one came out, and they both got extraordinarily good reviews for an independent author. To get a good review from Kirkus, the number one review company in America, is extraordinary. And that book was touted as a book, an author that should be read, is the way that one came from Kirkus. And the second one, my papa's story, I think it's even better than the first one. And that just got a tremendous review as well from Kirkus. They're both highly regarded. I have, as you're aware, written four novels, psychological thrillers. That's really how I got my start in writing. And they're all on Amazon. All of my works are on Amazon. But yeah, the two books, I'm very, very proud of these heritage books. Very proud of
Well,
them.
and you should be, and similar thing. I wrote about my family just recently. Yeah. And you know, I tell people the same thing too. Even if you don't want to publish it,
yeah,
you should write the stories down. You should write down what you know for the, you know, for the future of the family, you know, the people that are coming, you know, generations after us, so that they understand and that they know, because, you know, we're starting to lose that identity.
I live in a 55 and older community in Flanders, and a lot of my friends have been buying my books, and they come up to me and they say to me, "You are so fortunate that you wrote down these stories, that you had the opportunity, first off, to hear these stories, but second, that you thought enough to write them down. I wish I could tell my family the stories the way you're telling them in these books." And I say the same exact thing that you say, put as much as you can down in the books. In fact, one of the things that I recommend people do, my son did it with his grandparents, my mother and father, and then my wife's mother and father. He went and with a video camera had each of them just tell their stories, mm-hmm. and he videotaped them. And so, you know, they're telling how it was when they grew up. And, you know, we have these precious videos now of my mom and dad, my wife's mom and dad, talking about their childhoods and their development. But it's on video. It's not necessarily a book. But that's just another way of doing it, I think. You know, that,
sure.
Deserve
and you know, who knows? Numbers. Somebody might want to write a book from that at some point in time, you know? Yeah. So, yeah. It's however you record it. I mean, my uncle's grandson did the same thing. He was questioning him about World War II, you know, his service of World War II. And it's, you know, very interesting firsthand encounter of somebody that drove an LST in Iwo Jima. You know, it's fascinating. All right, well, just give us the names of the books again. And you said people could find them on Amazon.
Yeah, the first one is called The Evil Eye, The Pure Heart. I don't know if people can see that. I'm holding that up. Maybe you can see it.
There you go. It's a little blurry, but I'll overlay it.
Yep, okay. And the second one is called Compass Story. And that one is America Through the Eyes of a Brave Italian Immigrant. And it really, that book, I really had more of an opportunity to describe the hardships that Italians faced by being in a country that was anti-immigrant. You know, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy for these people. You know, I really, at the very end of Papa's story, I talk about what happened with the Italians who were interred in camps because of, you know, the suspicion that they were terrorist. It's just, you know, people don't understand what we had to do. Well, I think that we were finally accepted as a result of the servicemen, Italian servicemen in World War II, that we were then recognized as, you know, fully American. But up to that point, there was always a suspiciousness about us. You know,
yeah, I have my grandparents' alien cards. Yeah. You know, they were 60 years old when they had to register as aliens. You know, it was crazy. Yeah. I think you're right. You know, I had four uncles in the service at the same time during the war. And I think that certainly had a lot to do with people respecting them and considering them Americans, you know, from that point on.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Mike, thanks. I really appreciate you taking the time. And, you know, super books for anybody who wants to get some real good history about Italian-American family.
Yeah. Okay. Pleasure talking with you, Bob.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Sorrentino, just letting you know that my new book, Farmers and Nobles, is now available for sale on www.italiangenealogy.blog/farmersandnobles, or you can find the link in the podcast notes. Thanks for listening.